We'd love to hear from you because the history of baseball is broad and it's fascinating. And I'm sure some of you have questions. I will start out, first of all, and thank you so much for coming here to Toronto to join us. Every one of us here has a love for baseball, and there's an origin to that love of baseball. Where did yours come from?
From the cards. I loved the cards before I loved the game. And there's a bit of a background that I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest condensed version of. I came to this country as an immigrant. My parents are Holocaust survivors, so I was 2 and a half, speaking German already. And my struggle was to figure out what it was that I needed to do to become an American, which I really wanted. And to become an American, it struck me I needed to be at the very least one of the gang that hung out at the street corners and flipped cards against the wall. And if you got a leaner, of course, you took the other people's cards. So I started buying baseball cards in order to compete on the street. What I didn't realize was that my ability to read came from the backs of the cards and the backs of cereal boxes. So baseball was my education in how to become an American and eventually how to love the game.
Everybody here, I assume, knows what OPS is, yes? Well, we get to hear from the co-inventor of on-base plus slugging percentage. Give the audience here the explanation as to how that statistic came to life.
Well, I feel like I was present at the creation by virtue of writing The Hidden Game of Baseball and hanging out with the smartest man I've ever known, Pete Palmer. Now, I know things that Pete doesn't know and vice versa, but sitting around, and we did so many books together, I would recall sitting with him on the couch, and I was following his line of argument, and then all of a sudden he went around the corner and I had no idea how to follow him. He was lightning quick. His measure, on-base plus slugging, replaced an earlier attempt, which was on-base times slugging, which turned out to correlate better with projecting individual records, but it did not correlate as well with teams' won-loss records as the very best measures. OPS is a shortcut and it's a mathematical bastard because you have two denominators. It is not elegant from a mathematical standpoint. But why it has stuck is that it does reflect run scoring and predict run scoring. And it is the short way to express fancier versions of Bill James's runs created, our own linear weights, and ultimately win shares, which Bill James developed in around 2000. And now the dominant stat is WAR, wins above replacement, which both Pete and I have many arguments with, but OPS came in 1984 with The Hidden Game of Baseball, and that was the time when sabermetrics was my passion. It led to Total Baseball, which went through 8 editions as the encyclopedia of Major League Baseball. But in recent years, I think very little about statistics. And when I show up at statistical conferences, I'm regarded as Rip Van Winkle. You know, oh, didn't you do something 20 years ago? Yeah.
What has sabermetrics done for the game?
I think sabermetrics, your view of sabermetrics is tinged by where you come to the game from. So if you think sabermetrics is all you need for player evaluation and team construction, then you run up against conventional scouting wisdom. I think what we have done in swinging the pendulum back and forth is arrived at a consensus view represented by 30 out of 30 MLB teams now having statistical analytical departments, very well staffed, is that you cannot eliminate the human element and you cannot eliminate the metrics. The two have to work hand in hand.
Can you tell us when baseball was invented and by who?
I can tell you it wasn't invented in Cooperstown by Abner Doubleday, and it wasn't invented in Beachville as remembered by Adam Ford. And it wasn't invented in Pittsfield in 1791, where I found a bylaw in their archives banning the game of baseball along with cricket, wicket, fives, and bat ball. Fives being handball. Because if it was banned in 1791, it's not like it had just been invented in 1790. So my best research indicates that baseball, a game that we would characterize as one that had an opposing pitcher and a batter, and the need to run around the bases in a circuit, was played in North America as early as 1735. As to your answer of who invented it, the answer is no one. Baseball sprang up everywhere with rules variations, but it's like looking at a field of dandelions and saying, well, which of these was first? They all came up at pretty much the same time.
Why was Abner Doubleday then long promoted as the inventor of the game?
Well, we like to have single fathers. We like to have simple answers for complex questions. So the idea that baseball was a very good thing and was a binding force in American life for immigrants, for race and creed differences, we thought something so wonderful must have had an inventor. There must have been a Thomas Edison of baseball. Now, of course, Thomas Edison didn't invent everything that Thomas Edison is credited with. So Al Spaulding and Henry Chadwick, Al Spaulding, the sporting goods manufacturer, former ball player, Henry Chadwick, the great old scribe of the game born in Britain, had a long-standing argument as to whether baseball was originally a British game or a British game derived from rounders, or it was an American invention. The argument was settled by a three-year-long commission that settled upon Abner Doubleday because of a letter from a lunatic named Abner Graves, who wrote to the paper in Akron, the Akron Herald, I believe it was. And in this, the United States and Canada have much in common because you have your own lunatic in Adam Ford. Now, I understand that at St. Mary's they have a big billboard, baseball played here since 1838, maybe. I don't want to get between anybody and their belief, and I like a good story as much as the next guy. I mean, I like Ruth's Called Shot. I was asked by Steve here about Ruth's Called Shot, and my view is that fact is too good to check.
Bill Humber is here in the audience, too, so if anybody wants to discuss when this is all over the history of the game in this country, I know Bill will make himself available. It's a fascinating history, and I know your expertise is, or passion, maybe more specifically, is the 19th century. There's some incredible characters who played the game back then. How did the World Series evolve?
There used to be controversy about the origin of the World Series. Most people today think it started in 1903 as a contest between the American League and National League. It did not. The modern World Series started in 1905. That was the first one that represented a planned postseason contention between the winners of the pennants and the American League and National League. In 1903, there was an arrangement made between the owners of the Pittsburgh Pirates and Boston Red Sox that they would play a championship series, but it was not sanctioned by the leagues, who were still in a very tentative peace agreement. I believe that what we've had in the 20th century and to the present moment is a World Series between the American League and National League. There was, however, a World Series in the 19th century before the American League was a glimmer in Ben Johnson's eye. It was when the American Association was the rival league to the National League, and we had a thing that was called the World Championship Series and ultimately the World Series from 1884 through 1891. There were postseason contests between the leagues as early as 1882, exhibition matches between the Cincinnati Red Stockings and, I believe, the Chicago White Stockings. It used to be, if you read old baseball history books, they would call 1882 the first World Series. Now, you can see that I can get very far down a rabbit hole, and I can parse distinctions until all of you are fleeing for the exits. So I'll leave it there.
My favorite 19th century ball player was a guy by the name of Ed Delahanty, who was the Mike Trout of his day. Also one of the first greedy ball players.
He was the Scooter Jeanette of his day.
Yes, he was. Yeah, he hit 4 home runs in a single game. 2 of them were inside the park. He's in the Hall of Fame, elected in 1945, died in Canada. Do you know how he died?
Technically, right?
Or maybe he died right on the border.
Yeah.
Can you tell the story of how he perished?
When they found him, the obituary said that he was missing a leg. So the leg may have been in Canada, and the rest of him...
His tie was found in Canada. I think one of his feet was found in the United States.
Delahanty was a terrific player and an early inductee into the Baseball Hall of Fame. He was a tremendous hitter. Also a very big drinker and a difficult personality, made more difficult by drink. So on this trip with the Washington Senators in 1902, he had already received an overture from John McGraw of the National League to come jump to the Giants. So he may have been celebrating that he was soon to leave the woeful Washington Senators and join the equally woeful at that time New York Giants. But he became so nasty engaging in fistfights with people on the train that the conductor put him off without calling the constabulary. So he, in his drunken state, appeared to wander across the bridge and either go over the side or fall between some slats, and his body was found, I think, a week later. And there's you know, those who like conspiracy theories are finding people who pushed him or people who shouldn't have done this and should have done that. Delahanty is more interesting than his death, but his death is why we think of him at all.
How do you think Babe Ruth and Walter Johnson and Ty Cobb and players, the great stars of the early 1900s, would fare in 2017?
I was about to say, that's a great question. But the problem is that if they were to be teleported to modern day, they would be bigger. They would have had adolescence characterized by better nutrition. They would have had better training. They would have had sufficient salary not to need to get off-season jobs, as Walter Johnson did, as Ty Cobb did. The question is like asking, if Rembrandt were to be brought to the current era, would he be a better painter than Picasso? Well, the answer is, if he were brought to the current era, he wouldn't paint like Rembrandt. He'd probably paint like Picasso. So it's a very tough question, and you can answer it statistically, which gives you some... Dick Kramer did a study called Average Batting Skill back in 1972 and concluded that Ty Cobb would bat in the 320s, and Babe Ruth might have hit 600 home runs. I do believe that there are no good old days in baseball. The best days in baseball are right now. The best players that we have ever seen in the game are playing before our eyes, and this phony nostalgia that baseball promotes about its good old days blinds us to the fact that Walter Johnson threw sidearm, did not have a curveball. I doubt that he topped 93 or 94 miles an hour, which is probably as fast as anybody threw back then. In fact, I would say the guy who threw the fastest in the entire history of the game, as perceived by the batter, was Amos Rusey and perhaps Cy Young in 1892, the year before they changed the pitching distance. So if you have a 93-mile-an-hour fastball coming at you from 55 feet, that's better than Aroldis Chapman can manage.
So you're saying that this is the golden age of baseball right now?
Yep.
Interesting.
And Mike Trout, if he were to be teleported to King Kelly's day, say late 1880s, might bat 650.
Right.
This is what I believe.
Yes. Explain why.
The athletes are so much better. The eye-hand coordination is so much better. The training is better. The physiology is enhanced, generally, legally. And I think the hitters of the 1880s and 1890s, they could mount statistics that, and the pitchers as well, could post statistics that are unmatchable today because the conditions of play have changed. You could not have Will White throwing 76 games, 75 of them being complete, while throwing 680 innings in a season. You could not have Willie Keeler going through an entire season without striking out. Why did he not strike out? Well, he had a short, choppy stroke, but the pitchers were throwing 82 miles an hour, 83 miles an hour. So the game is better. Now, I understand the mythic reason for imagining that there's never been a guy like Ruth. There's never been a guy like Cobb or Johnson or Mathewson or Wagner. But I don't believe they could hold a candle to the players that we've seen in the last 20 years. So when I'm asked, who was the greatest player you ever saw, it's always Barry Bonds or Ted Williams, because I'm old enough to have seen Ted Williams. And who was the greatest pitcher of all time? I think it's Roger Clemens. I don't think it's Cy Young. In fact, interesting story. Does anybody here know why the Cy Young Award is named for Cy Young? Aha. Do I get a hand? I can't see.
No hands.
No, nobody knows nothing. Okay. Cy Young died in 1953 or 1954, I'm forgetting which. And when they decided to have a pitcher's award in order to give the pitchers something, because they were never qualified for the MVP the way people were voting back then, they decided that since the award was only going to be one award for both leagues, and the first Cy Young was won by Don Newcomb of the Brooklyn Dodgers, one award for both leagues, they needed a pitcher who had accomplished great things in each league. And Cy Young was the only one to have won 200 plus games in each, the American League and National League.
Interesting. So it could have easily been the Christy Mathewson Award. But
or the Lefty Grove Award. Right. I mean, there were better pitchers than Cy Young.
Are you surprised? In 1920, Ray Chapman was hit and killed by a pitch from a man named Carl Mays. Are you surprised that in all the time that has passed, almost 100 years, it's never happened again?
It's happened at the minor league level, and we came damn close to it happening with Don Zimmer. Zimmer was in a coma, I believe, for 10 days after being hit by Hal Jeffcoat with a purpose pitch. This was a definite beanball attempt. So it is incredibly fortunate that we haven't had another fatality. Batting helmets help in that regard. But the thing I worry about is a batter who gets turned around in the batter's box by a pitch and gets hit below the helmet in the neck area. I believe that's where the vulnerability lies.
Because batters were wearing ball caps up until about 1958, 59, somewhere
around
there?
That's correct. A couple of them who had had bean balls, who had really serious injuries, would put a metal liner under their cloth cap, unbeknownst to the press, because they thought it was sissy stuff to give in to the pitcher.
I'm in full support of Josh Donaldson wearing that new face guard, and I'm in full support of anybody who chooses to do it. I've noticed, as you have probably as well, that so many players are now choosing to wear face guards in Major League Baseball. Question for the audience, and take some time to think about it if you will. What is the most important moment in the history of the Toronto Blue Jays? We've seen some really important home runs. We've seen one no-hitter. We've seen division championships. We've seen two World Series championships. What do you think, yes, is the most important moment or play in the history of the Blue Jays?
I would say the day they traded for Joe Carter and Tommy.
The day they traded for those two? Okay, interesting. More of a development than a moment. Okay. What about a play? Is there a, can you actually say this is the most important home run that this team has ever hit. Yes.
I know everyone will say it's the Joe Carter home run, but I think it's the Bautista.
Can you speak up a little bit, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I know most people think it's the Joe Carter home run to win the 93 World Series.
Yeah.
But I think it's the Bautista.
Bautista's home run?
Because it had been so long. And it was the capper to that magical August and September into October. And it unified this country in a way that I don't think the 92 and 93 World Series did.
Interesting perspective. Anybody else? Yeah, right there.
I think it's the Alomar home run against Oakland, for sure, because that was the catalyst to get the World Series.
I can't disagree.
The second one is Ed Sprague's home run in Game 2 of the World Series.
Two home runs before Joe Carter's walk-off?
Carter's at least third, maybe fifth.
Anyone else? Do you? Yeah, sorry, the lights are blinding.
I would say Alomar's number one, but I think a lot of people neglect to think about Devon White's catch in the 92 World Series, which should have been a triple play.
Yeah.
That wasn't. I mean, I think, you know, defensively, you know, a guy like Devon, like Kevin Pillar, for example, gets a lot of clout for making the diving catches, but Devo didn't have to dive.
Yeah.
You know, Devo just got the ball.
Well, that's the kind of crap we used to hear about Joe DiMaggio. He was so graceful, he never had to dive for a ball. Right? And then range factor came in, and we realized that Joe DiMaggio was the fifth best center fielder in the American League.
If you asked, and I've asked Devon White about this, he's like, dude, how come you never dove? And he said to me, I never had to. So maybe that's his way of, you know.
As Greg likes to call it, a TV dive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Saw a few of those from Ezekiel Carrera recently. Sorry to pick on Z. Do you have an opinion, given that the franchise in this city has seen one of just two World Series-ending home runs, do you have an opinion on whether or not that's the most important moment in the history of the local ball club?
I can't say, because one of our respondents referred to the way the home run united the nation.
Now, yes.
I can't feel for, I have no gauge for that. I can tell you, when I think of the Toronto Blue Jays history, what stands out to me is all those near no-hitters that Dave Steeb threw.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Steeb, to me, is a sabermetric god and should have been in the Hall of Fame long ago. And I don't even know what kind of support he gets in this town, but he was a very, very great pitcher, and for a long time.
If he had been a Yankee, would he have been in the Hall of Fame?
Yes, all Yankees go to the Hall of Fame. I believe Aaron Judge is already in.
Yes, I wouldn't doubt it for a second. I'm sure many of you have seen the film that Mr. Thorne here helped create, that was done in 1994, the monstrosity known as baseball, by Ken Burns. Can you elaborate on your involvement in putting that very, very important film together?
I was one of several consultants at the very early stages, at the point where we were considering baseball as a three-evening, five-hour opus that would focus on the Cubs and the Red Sox. And I helped to open up the perspective. And we got not only an 18-and-a-half-hour film over nine innings, plus another 4 hours a decade later when we did the 10th inning, we had over 100 hours of vibrant, wonderful footage. If we could have run a 100-hour documentary, we would have, but the people wouldn't have stood for it. A lot of people said 18 hours on baseball, what are you smoking? As it was, anyone who wants to see the full 100 hours can view it by going to the University of North Carolina and watching it. It's there, but you cannot see it broadcast because we didn't clear rights for the footage we didn't use. So it will never see the light of day unless you go to it. It cannot come to you.
Questions for Mr. Thorne? Yes, sir.
So there's this documentary on Netflix called Fastball, and it talks about how the fastball has evolved over the years. And there was really one interesting test about how they would throw a fastball at the same time that a police cruiser was going by, and if it hit this screen before the cruiser, that's how they measured the speed. And it talks about this one pitcher, his name was Steve Dalkowski, apparently having the fastest pitch ever at 125.
Not only does he have the fastest pitch ever, but he continues to get faster years after his death.
that was one of the comments made, but I don't have you... In the documentary, they say there's not much information about him, but have you ever researched him at all, or is there any information?
Sure, I did a book in 1985, co-author with John Holloway, who's a great expert on the Negro Leagues, called The Complete Book of the Pitcher. And it traced the entire history of pitching from the 1840s to 1985. And we asked the question of who was the fastest ever. And our judgment was that all of the old measurements, whether they're police cars or motorcycles or radar, which I believe Bob Feller was measured with, they're all baloney. This is the great thing about our game. We all know it's full of baloney. And we love it anyway, or we love it because of the baloney, because the stories are so good. So everything is offered up with a wink and a nudge. So if you tell me Steve Dalkowski was the fastest pitcher ever, and you have evidence, I'm all ears. If you just have an opinion, well, I'll say, why should I disturb you? I'll go to somebody else.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Thor, I'm a teacher, and one of the tales I tell my students that awes them is the Babe Ruth's first professional home run was hit just a few kilometers from here. But I know there's a competing American claim to that. So what is your thinking? Is the first professional home run Toronto?
His first professional under contract organized baseball home run is hit at Hanlon's Point. He did hit an earlier home run in spring training, but spring training games don't count. If we're going to start spring training games as part of the accounting system, why not go to backyard baseball and wiffle ball?
Do people challenge you at trivia when you go out?
I get stuff wrong. I have in my life. When I've had a blooper, it's been a whopper. I wrote a book in 1981 called Baseball's 10 Greatest Games, and of course one of them is the Bobby Thompson game of 1951. Game three, down 4-1, they score 4 and win 5-4. In this book, I say there were 2 outs in the ninth. Only years after it was published that I realized there was 1 out in the ninth. And this is not the internet where you write a blog entry and you can go in and change your stupidity and no one will notice.
Sorry, that was actually going to be one of my questions, because the National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum claims that it was Fayetteville, North Carolina.
That was the spring.
I believe as well, because he had signed a pro contract.
He signed a pro contract, but it was a spring training game.
But he was still a professional when he was playing. I live here in Toronto, whatever, but at the same time, he had signed a pro contract and actually hit a home run for the Baltimore Orioles, who were part of the National League at the time.
Oh, look, baseball is so susceptible to weasel words and parsing. So I can say, who was the first left-handed pitcher with a hangnail against whom Babe Ruth hit a home run? You know, you can qualify and qualify and qualify, but the first regular season game and his only minor league home run was Hanlon's Point.
Sometimes you just have to let legend flow right over you. Just accept it.
And those people in the audience who live in Fayetteville, maybe they can leave now.
Bill, I hate to put you on the spot, but I was always taught that the longest recorded throw of a baseball was by a Canadian by the name of Glenn Gorbis in Calgary, or from Calgary, who played briefly with the Philadelphia Phillies. Is that a tale that you're familiar with? Because it's one that was shoved down my throat.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how we would ever
measure that. There's a lot of flat land out there near Calgary.
Let me ask John a question about the International Association, the first significant rival to the National League, formed in 1877, only lasts a couple of seasons, but never...
And now when the Canadian team drops out, they rename themselves the National Association.
Exactly.
but never adopted a subservient attitude towards the National League. It's not considered a major league in the annals. The National Association is, all the Union, the Players League, et cetera, et cetera. Where do you stand on the International Association, which had two Canadian members from Guelph and London?
I would say that the way Major League Baseball defines a major league would knock the International Association out because some of the clubs played on the cooperative or gate-sharing basis. And I think that's the killer. And that
four teams in the National Association did of 1871.
And the, National Association is no longer considered a major league. The National Association of 1871 through 75 was in all the encyclopedias, the official encyclopedia of Major League Baseball as issued in 1951 all the way up into the 1970s, included National Association teams. Now, no longer. What is my personal view? My personal view is that if Cap Anson played in all of the years 1871 through 75, he did not become Major League the following year. So I would say the National Association, on a quality basis and the fact that there was really no competing league in those years, would be a major league, but Major League Baseball thinks otherwise. On an official position, probably because Hulbert's genius in 1876 was not forming the best club that anybody had ever seen, but rather that it established the principle of capital controlling labor. And this became the principle of every sports league that followed. The National League was the model for the European Football League of 1880, the first professional football league. So we have extracurricular reasons for how we classify things. And the International Association on the matter of how its teams competed against, say, National League clubs did very well indeed.
Ashley, question?
Of your thoughts on Pete Rose and the Hall of Fame.
Who is not in the Hall of Fame that should be in the Hall of Fame?
Do you think that people who are unethical should be considered
in the Hall of Fame? There are plenty of unethical people in the Hall of Fame. So, we're closing the barn door after the cow is gone. Pete Rose is a special case. I will tell you that the Hall of Fame changed its induction criteria to say no man who is on baseball's ineligible list will be permitted on the ballot, and any write-in votes he gets will not be counted. This was directed only at Pete Rose, but it is thought to include Joe Jackson, Eddie Seacott, Chick Gandel, any number of other, Buck Weaver, any number of players. The simple fact of the matter is that the Hall of Fame made a blunder because Major League Baseball has no ineligible list except for two people, Pete Rose and Henry Mejia. Henry Mejia, of the Mets relief pitcher, has been permanently banned from baseball. He can appeal his status in a year or two. But once you die, and this is not the Vatican, we don't continue to punish you. Galileo did not play for any of the current Major League clubs. So what do I think about Pete Rose? I think he needs to be kept out of the Hall of Fame, not because he's on the ineligible list, but because he can't keep his own story straight from one decade to the next as to his level of involvement. And in the most recent consideration, Commissioner Manfred said there's no evidence that he has reconfigured his life. I believe that is the exact phrase that he used. And Major League Baseball was looking for some change or some form of contrition. They weren't going to get it. Now, does Pete Rose belong in the Hall of Fame because of his playing credentials? Absolutely. Would he be one of the top 30 players in the Hall of Fame if he were admitted? No. His accomplishments are vastly overrated because he was flashy. But I hate the idea of baseball writers who cheat on their wives when they go on the road being the ones to rule on the morality of Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens. I think morality ought to be kept out of these considerations. And as your electorate at the Hall of Fame ages, and some of the more inveterate scolds among the writers pass from the scene, I think modern voters, those who have recently got their 10 years time in or are about to, will look more kindly on Clemens and Bonds and Sosa and others. But Pete Rose is a case unto himself, and I don't wish to judge him. So if you're asking me my opinion of when he will get into the Hall of Fame, I believe never.
Yes. Yes, you.
So many questions.
So little time.
So little time. I wanted to ask you.
We'll always have Paris.
We will. I wanted to ask you a number of things, but what I'm most curious about is just sort of what you're still in capacity as the official historian of Major League Baseball. Is that your title?
You should believe everything I said because of that.
So far, so good. Can you walk us through maybe sort of what your average day is or what your official purview in that role is?
Sure.
How long you plan to stay in the role? Who's coming up in your rearview mirror that might step into that role? Was
there an internship?
Well, Satchel Paige said, don't look behind you. Something may be catching up, right? So I don't look behind me, and I serve at the pleasure of the commissioner. I've served at the pleasure of two commissioners. I'm not Papa Doc Duvalier. I don't have this position for life. And if someone younger, prettier, smarter comes along that the current commissioner or a subsequent commissioner would think, let's give this guy a shot or this girl a shot, I will gladly take my exit and on to the next thing, provided I still have my marbles, of course, which at this moment I believe I do. So if you want to know what an average day looks like, I'm attached to the Office of the Commissioner, nominally to the Public Relations Department, because there's no other department to attach me to. I'm a one-man department. So I appear in New York when requested. I have a request to appear on Tuesday, and I will be there. The last time I had a request was 3 years ago. So I don't go to New York City to do my work. I start my day with a pot of coffee and don't get out of my bathrobe until 10 o'clock because I'm responding to social media, to emails, to conundra that are presented to me by people within baseball and without. But within baseball, I mean within Major League Baseball and without. So I interact with the publicity department, I interact with the legal department, I interact with marketing, but I'm there to serve. I'm not in the role of making decisions for anybody. For example, the National Association National League conflict. I'm on the wrong side, personally, of the issue that Major League Baseball has decided the other way. I'm okay with it. I'm a big boy. I don't have to win everyone. But my job, this is the only job in my entire life for which I've been uniquely suited, because what they wanted from me was for me to be me, and I know how to do that.
Explain why the current commissioner's decision to implement the rule whereby you can automatically walk a batter without having to throw four wide was not necessarily implemented just to speed up the game.
I will speak to this point from a matter of personal belief rather than pretend that I have inside information from the halls of Major League Baseball or that Rob Manfred called me and said, say, John, what do you think we ought to do here? I don't get calls like that. Rules changes are proposed by Major League Baseball and then okayed or not, almost always not, by the Players Association. There is no more conservative body on earth than the players, who would like to play the game the way they played it when they were in American Legion ball for the rest of their lives. I believe that the waving the batter to first rather than throwing four wides was not intended to speed up the game, though it may save 15 seconds every three games. It instead was intended as a shot across the bow of the Players Association to indicate to them that they were not going to strangle the progress of the game, and that in fact the collective bargaining agreement did not permit them to veto reasonably propose rule changes ad infinitum. So the shot across the bow was that this rule was implemented without the Players Association, and that you may see more in this fashion.
By the way, I sat on that bench like you did. If you have to stand up and stretch your butt, please feel free. You won't be bothering us, or if you have to use the bathroom, get up and do so.
If you have to use the bathroom, do go to the bathroom.
Yes, please. We don't have much more time, so we'll continue with the question and answer. Yes, sir.
Can you tell us about like maybe your most memorable game that you've watched or seen?
Oh, gosh. I think, you know, my answer will probably be the same as yours, or yours, or yours. My most memorable game was my first. May 12th, 1957. We have different first games. But we all have, weirdly, almost as if it were an extraterrestrial experience, like three encounter movie of Spielberg's. What's the title of it?
Close Encounters.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The experience is, if you're a city kid and you go to the ball field and you come up through the runway and you see more grass than you believed was anywhere in the whole wide world, and your dad buys you popcorn and a hot dog and a soda, and in my case, my hero, Duke Snyder, hit a home run. Johnny Padres, the hero of the 1955 World Series, threw a shutout.
At the Polo Grounds.
So that's my most memorable, most important game. But I've had the good fortune to be in the stands for the Bill Buckner game, for the three home run games by Reggie Jackson against the Dodgers, Albert Pujols against the Cardinals, Pablo Sandoval against whoever he was playing against when he was with the Giants.
Detroit.
So I've gotten to see some really remarkable achievements. But what I have not, the two things I have not done, I have never caught a foul ball, and I must have been to 2,000 games, and I have never seen a no-hitter in person.
Wow. My first game was rained out. I'm such a loser. Seriously, check the Blue Jays schedule in April of 1977, the first weekend series against Boston. The Saturday game was washed out. Arturo, is that you, Arturo? Away you go.
Hi, John. Should Marvin Miller be in the Hall of Fame?
You'll have to speak up for me.
Should Marvin Miller be in the Hall
should
of
Marvin
Fame?
Should Marvin Miller be in the Hall of Fame?
Second question. Why the owners elected William Eckert as the fourth commissioner?
Well, first question. Miller clearly belongs in the Hall of Fame. He's one of the 10 most important people in the history of baseball. And for him to be rejected by the Veterans Committee, which is largely composed of ex-players, is staggering. And whether Reggie Jackson was one of those players who voted against him, which was widely reported, I can't say. I don't know. But what the resentment is, I think today's servants become tomorrow's rulers, right? And they adopt the attitudes of those who formerly persecuted them. So Miller seems to me a particularly egregious omission. Other omissions, while I'm at it, Dick Allen and Minnie Minoso. Not to mention from the early days, Doc Adams and Al Reach. Now, to your last question, which you'll have to rephrase for me, please.
I'm reading a lot about baseball.
Oh, Eckert.
Yeah.
How did they nominate Eckert? They thought that after Ford Frick, they needed somebody with more general stature and clout. And they took the word general literally because Eckert had a military career, not particularly distinguished as far as anyone can tell. He knew nothing about baseball, nothing whatsoever. And his commissionership is conducted largely in absentia. So when he left the office, hardly anyone noticed.
You mentioned foul balls. This ball was used in Saturday's loss to the Yankees at the Rogers Center. Sarah, I want you to have this because you let me butt in front of you when I needed to go to the bathroom. It's First time I've ever been at pitch talks without kids in the audience. I told my friend Steve Payne here, I said, I'm going to bring a ball that I had from Saturday's game and give it to the first kid I see in the audience. Welcome to the bar, kid. Have a drink. Any other questions?
Who's in the Hall of Fame that shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame?
Ooh, I was going to ask that too.
My answer is no one, because the people who are ripping down the plaques or would be first online to rip down a plaque, they get the wrong guys. You know, you look at Rabbit Moranville and you say the guy batted 250. Well, the league batted less than 250 most of the years. And this is a guy who was still playing shortstop at age 39 before he broke his leg and had to move to second. If you're playing shortstop at 39, you're pretty damn good. So there are people about whom very little is known. And I'm not even talking about executives. Now, Bowie Kuhn is in and Marvin Miller is out. This seems outrageous to some. I don't think it's outrageous. You can put accomplishments against Bowie Kuhn's record. Rick Ferrell, I've heard it said that the wrong Ferrell got in, that they meant to put in Wes.
His brother was better looking.
Well, he didn't have to wear that mask.
That's true. Wes was once voted the most handsome man in baseball, as I recall, Wes Ferrell. But
so,
I'm sorry to interrupt.
It's quite all right. My point is that lack of historical perspective and understanding will permit the casual fan to look at the statistics of certain Hall of Famers and say, like Bill Mazeroski, he doesn't belong. Well, he was only the greatest fielding second baseman ever at the time he retired. May still be, for all I know. I wouldn't pull him. I wouldn't pull him, even though he has had the brevets stripped from his shoulders. He invented nothing. At the time that he was put in, he was regarded as a counterweight to Abner Doubleday. Cartwright got a plaque. Doubleday got a building. Neither had anything to do with the invention of baseball. Both went to their graves not knowing they had invented the game. So, do you have some clinkers in there? Sure, but I'm not interested in a Stalinist purge of the Hall of Fame.
There was a time when I was utterly fascinated by the Black Sox scandal, and I managed to find a phone number for a Felsch in Milwaukee, and I picked up
good
the phone
for you.
And called, and it was Happy Felsch's granddaughter, and we had a wonderful conversation. Why was gambling actually good for baseball?
Well, gambling was good for baseball until it wasn't. I think that if you hadn't had gambling in the game in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, the game would not have attracted the attention of the press. It would not have attracted the attention of adults who were inveterate gamblers. There's nothing dishonorable about being a gambler. In fact, the most honorable thing you could do in that culture was be a gambler who risked all and lost, because then you had character. Not money, but character. I think the number of games that were fixed, or World Series that were fixed, or World Series games that were fixed, or attempted to be fixed, they're legion. And somebody asked me before we went up here, well, would you whitewash the records of the 1870s and 80s, perhaps, maybe he was thinking reduce all of those batting averages by 20% because a lot of the games were fixed. No, there's no intellectual reason for invalidating the past in any systematic way because of a current understanding. I like Abner Doubleday. I've come to terms with him. I spent 28 years writing baseball in the Garden of Eden. I did other things along the way because my family had grown accustomed to eating. But I spent the first 20 years of that book determined to tell the real story of how baseball began. And then I realized nobody cares about Abner Doubleday or Alexander Cartwright. The most interesting thing about the early history of baseball is the lying. The lying about everything, and then the subsequent lying to redo the lies of the people who... So baseball is emblematic of our culture, alas, and for the better. And lying and gambling and chicanery and bad behavior are all a part of it, and that's why we love it. It's just like us.
I'm going to take one more question. I'm going to give it to the guy with the Pirates hat because they haven't won a World Series since 1979, so I feel bad for you like I feel bad for people from Cleveland. You go ahead.
I just like the hat. I was wondering, now...
Speak up for me.
Yeah, so now there's a player in Japan of some renown as a two-way...
Ohtani.
Yeah, Shohei Ohtani. And just on Sports Illustrated, a few issues ago, there was a high schooler in the States, Hunter Green, I believe is his name, also two-way player. I was wondering, obviously, Babe Ruth, famous for being proficient at batting and pitching.
And Guy Hecker in 1886,
and I know you were going to bring him up next.
I was not. I was going to ask.
He won 26 games as a pitcher and led the league in batting with a mark of 341. But go on.
He was getting to that.
No, that was my question, was what other people have I not heard of? You have a very interesting story. We're excellent at both ways.
There were several two-way players, and the aforementioned Wes Farrell was one. I think he had 35 home runs as a pitcher and was frequently used as a pinch hitter and occasionally a position player. I believe that the momentum for an Ohtani is irresistible as long as Major League Baseball keeps the rosters at 25 men. You now have many clubs carrying 13 pitchers, which leaves you stripped on the bench. There's no place on the bench for a Matt Stairs, a guy who will hit a home run to win a game for you, but can only play one position, if that. Everybody on the bench today has to be a Swiss Army knife, and that's because we're carrying too many pitchers. Now, the solution could be to expand the roster, or it could be to change the way we play the game.
Adam Loewen, pitcher, outfielder, yes, of recent vintage. It's been an honor to sit here with you, Mr. Thorne.
My pleasure entirely.
And this conversation does not have to end. Conversation does not have to end. If you'd like to continue to discuss the history of this great game, we'll do so next door at the Mill Street Brew Pub, if that's all right with you.
I understand they have food there.
They may, in fact, have food. Your attendance here was greatly appreciated. Please give a round of applause to Major League Baseball's historian, Mr. John Thorne.
You are tremendous. Thank you.